It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
Do you think human-induced climate emergency is a threat to the United States?
Well, what I will tell you is that we'll always follow the science on that in this administration.
The science says
what we won't do, and the Clean Power Plan was all about that, was hamstringing energy in this country, raising the cost of utility rates for working families across this country.
But is it a threat?
While other nations like China and India do absolutely nothing or make illusory promises decades down the road to deal with it. You know, the truth of the matter is, with the advent of natural gas, with the natural gas explosion that's developing, with clean coal technology, we're seeing a significant reduction in carbon emissions all across this country.
But is what people are calling a climate emergency, is it a threat? Do you think it's a threat? Man-made climate emergency is a threat?
I think the answer to that is going to be based upon the science.
Well, the science says yes. I'm asking you what you think.
There's many in the science that...
The science community in your own administration at NOAA, at the DNI, they all say it's a threat.
Look, what the president has said, what we've said is that we are not going to raise utility rates. Remember what President Obama said?
But it's not a threat.
He had his climate change plan. He said it's necessarily going to cause utility rates to skyrocket, and that would force us into these green technologies. Now you got Democrats all running for president that are running on a Green New Deal that would break this economy.
So you don't think it's a threat, is all I'm saying. You don't think it's a threat.
I think we're making great progress reducing carbon emissions. America has the cleanest air and water in the world. We'll continue to use market forces.
We don't have the cleanest air and water in the world.
You
get back to me with some statistics.
But we're making progress on reducing carbon emissions. Mm-hmm. We're doing it through technology, through natural gas, through continuing to support, as our administration
rolled back all these clean.
Turn back to nuclear energy, clean energy. The answer, though, is not to raise the utility rates of millions of utility ratepayers across the country.
Well, that was CNN's Jake Tapper grilling the Vice President of the United States, Mike Pence, telling him what he should know about man-made climate change, insisting that the Vice President admit that it is a threat, and correcting him that the science, in fact, does say yes, but you won't say it's a threat, and then arguing with him that we have clean air and water in this country, and then just muttering under his breath that, but you roll back the Clean Air Act. So mocking him while sort of interviewing him, it was really bizarre exchange. But it kind of tells you where we are and what the nature of this dispute over man-made climate change and the fact that men have not made the climate change debate is. Well, no one knows more about what the truth is here than my next guest, because Cal Beisner is the founder and president of the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation. If you don't know about Cornwall, let me just tell you a little bit about it. It's a network of evangelical Christian scholars, mostly natural scientists, economists, theologians, philosophers, and ethicists. And they work together to promote biblical earth stewardship, or what's called godly dominion, also the economic development of the world's poor, and the proclamation of defense of the gospel. And I want to read their mission statement because it kind of makes those three things make sense. We seek to magnify the glory of God in creation, the wisdom of his truth in environmental stewardship, the kindness of his mercy in lifting the needy out of poverty, and the wonders of his grace in the gospel of Jesus Christ. Cal Beisner, again, is the founder. I met Cal when he was a professor in Florida. He was a professor at Covenant College, at Knox Theological Seminary. He was on staff at Holy Trinity Presbyterian Church in Fort Lauderdale, and now he works full-time in establishing and maintaining the Cornwall Alliance. That's a long introduction, but Dr. Cal Beisner, thanks for joining me.
So
Sandy, it's so great to be back with you. I really appreciate your explaining to folks what we do. There is a sort of a shorter way to do it. My wife always tells people, we're trying to save the planet from the people who are trying to save the planet.
I like that. I think that's a very good description of what you're doing. I'd be curious to know, because I don't really know the answer to this. Where do you think the balance of power on this debate, man-made climate change versus men cannot affect climate change, those two opinions that are diametrically opposed, where is the balance of power right now in that argument?
Well, when you put the question that way, the balance of power, I think the answer is pretty clear. The balance of power is with those who insist that human emissions of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases are causing catastrophically dangerous global warming that threatens all of human civilization and perhaps threatens all of life on Earth, and that we need to spend trillions of dollars trying to mitigate that, trying to reduce the global warming. That's where the power is, because that's where the politics and money are. But there's something else. There's something called truth. And, you know, there's the old phrase of speaking truth to power. Last year, the Cornwall Alliance published a wonderful little book by Dr. Roy W. Spencer, who's really one of the top climate scientists in the world. He's at the University of Alabama at Huntsville. And he and his colleague, Dr. John Christie, both strong evangelical Christians and both outstanding climate scientists, run the satellite global temperature monitoring system for NASA. That is the best source we have for global temperature data. And Dr. Spencer wrote an interesting little book called An Inconvenient Deception. And it's a response, actually, to Al Gore's second book, An Inconvenient Sequel. And we put on the front cover a cartoon of Roy Spencer as David and Al Gore as Goliath. And in Gore's hand, there's a sword labeled Power. And in Roy's hand, there is a sword labeled truth. That's what we believe in, is speaking truth to power. And the truth on this, as opposed to the power, is that, yeah, carbon dioxide probably makes the atmosphere a little warmer than it otherwise would be. The interesting question is how much. And the empirical evidence, not the climate models, which can be tweaked to give you any answer you want, the empirical evidence is that the answer to that is probably so little that we cannot detect it. And part of what tells us that is that the climate models have predicted roughly three times as much warming as actually observed over the last 40 years, the period for which we have satellite data. And we can't even know that all of that warming came from added CO2 in the atmosphere, because we know that natural causes have caused warming repeatedly in the past. So the warming is certainly less than the models say, and the best empirical studies indicate that it's very, very little, not dangerous, and it would be absurd for us to implement the Paris Climate Treaty, which would call for spending roughly $70 to $140 trillion between now and the end of the century in order to present a grand total of 0.17 degree or 0.3 of a degree Fahrenheit of warming by the end of the century. That's 23.3 to 46.6 $1 trillion per tenth of a degree Fahrenheit of presented warming. I don't think it's surprising that the author of the Art of the Deal thought that was a bad deal.
You know, Cal, would you say it's safe to say that I this is my assessment, and I really, since you live and breathe this, you would have a better perspective. It certainly seems like pop culture, late night comedians, public schools.
Oh yeah.
And television everywhere, movies, everything, are all embracing that this is true. Politicians are doing the same thing on the left. But actually, because it seems to me, because Donald Trump is in the White House, lots of really bad things are being blocked. So the power, the actual right. power right now, seems to be in the court of truth. But the public perception is not the same. It's like they are diametrically opposed. Do you see that any differently than what I just said?
Yeah, I think you make a really good point there, Sandy. And yet, there remains the deep state. The fact is that most of the bureaucrats below the cabinet or near cabinet level in agencies like the EPA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NASA, the Department of the Interior, and so on, most of the lower level bureaucrats who are the ones who really exercise the power still believe in catastrophic man-made warming. So for President Trump and for the new EPA director, Andy Weaver, and others to, to pursue what I think are really sound policies on this is one thing. For them to be able really to get those policies implemented is another thing entirely. And how long those policies will last depends an awful lot on the next election cycle. Because, frankly, what's done just by bureaucratic means under the executive branch, it is easily reversed by the next the next executive. What we really need is for Congress to get over its cowardice and try to actually deal with this in legislation. But most of the members of Congress are scared to death to touch it because they know that it would cost trillions of dollars to do anything worth looking at about climate, whereas the impact of that would be practically zero in terms of temperature difference, while it would cost American taxpayers, as I said, trillions of dollars. So Congress doesn't want to touch it.
Let me just let me ask something probably hard to answer quickly, but it is interesting to me that you kind of landed on the verbiage global warming again. You talked about that, the change of temperature, rather than saying man-made climate change, which is what the left, quickly pivoted to when all those models were turned out to be false and the fraud was exposed, brought about, 8 years ago, I'm guessing, something like that.
Yes.
And so they talk about is man-made climate change, but you'd mentioned now global warming. Why is that? Are they still using that term?
The two terms are not exactly interchangeable, and it's really been interesting over the last roughly 30 years, Sandy, to watch the public rhetoric on this. The really scientific folks have always talked in terms of climate change. The UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change was the name given to that organization when it was first proposed back in about 1990 and actually started in 1991. So that was their preferred language. But at the time, we were observing a fairly rapid period of global warming. And so they tended to make the two terms interchangeable. The media, though, right away picked up on the global warming, and so they and the entertainment industry and most lower-level educators and whatnot spoke in terms of global warming. Then the big problem for the whole thing hit, and that was that 1998 was the warmest year on record, according to the best data we have, the satellite data, and there has been absolutely zero statistically significant upward trend in global average temperature since then. So the popularizers realize we can't talk in terms of global warming anymore. We have to talk in terms of climate change. But once you get rid of the warming from climate change, all of a sudden there's nothing to worry about. Because as a matter of fact, if the temperature is not changing significantly, then you're not going to see any changes in anything driven by temperature, whether hurricanes or tornadoes or floods or droughts or hot heat waves or anything else.
And
the reality is that in all those things, the trends are downward, not upward, contrary to the predictions.
So thus a different inconvenient truth than Al Gore had in mind. By the way, my guest is Dr. Cal Beisner. He is, of course, the founder of Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation. It's cornwallalliance.org. I'll tell you that right up front because we're going to share with you a lot of really interesting things today. We want to talk about whether it's true when AOC and others say that capitalism is bad for the environment. And what are some of the other things they're claiming? Are they true and are they not? Be back right after this. Okay.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
I think that the part of it that is generational is that millennials and people and, you know, Gen Z and all these folks that come after us are looking up, and we're like, the world is going to end in 12 years if we don't address climate change. And your biggest issue is your biggest issue is how are we going to pay for it? Mm-hmm. And like, this is the war. This is our World War II.
So, in the words of AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the world is going to end in 12 years because of man-made climate change. No wonder Jake Tapper asked the vice president if he thought it was a threat, because according to her, it is a threat, and so Jake must believe that it is a threat. Well, my guest is Cal Beisner, Dr. Cal Beisner, the founder of Cornwall Alliance, and he's written a new booklet, I'd say. It's called, Is Capitalism Bad for the Environment? Is it true that because of capitalism and the waste, and I think of the oil spills, I think of the pollution, I think of the oceans with their plastic bags, the balloons now that have just been found in the ocean, terrible, awful balloons that we use for parties, because of our wealth and our success and because of the success of industry, we are in fact polluting the earth. That seems to be the narrative. Well, we turn to Cal because he's just written an expose on this. Is capitalism bad for the environment? For the answers. So, Cal, you trace this whole notion about the connection between governmental systems and the treatment of the environment back to the 30s and 50s. In your preface to this book, I just found that fascinating. Can you tell us how this has come about?
Yeah, well, Sandy, really, say the 1920s into the 1950s, even a little bit into the 60s, it was really an interesting question, which sort of an economy, a free market or capitalistic economy on the one hand, or a more centrally planned socialistic economy on the other hand, would create more wealth and get it into the hands of more people. That was really an interesting question. We hadn't had a historical record to go on. But by the early 1960s, it was becoming increasingly clear that, frankly, there was no contest. By the 70s, it was obvious to everyone that free market or capitalist economies created more wealth and got it into the hands of more people than socialistic, centrally planned economies. But there are plenty of people in this world who are utopians, who basically see the state as the incarnation of God. And in that, they're taking their thinking from George Hegel of the 19th century, the philosopher. And they really want a state to dominate everything. And so they had to find a different rationale for their preference for the state to rule everything. And what they hit on was the environment. They started saying, look, capitalism, the free market, harms the environment. We need the state to protect the environment. And the only way it can do that is by taking control of all the major aspects of the economy, especially the energy sector, because that's at the very root of the economy. And so what you had was a lot of these folks became involved in the starting of what were called the green parties, starting off in Scandinavia and Western Europe, and then moving into Great Britain, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and then eventually in the United States as well. So what you've got is an argument for socialism that says, okay, it may not lift people out of poverty as well. It may not spread wealth to as many people, but at least it protects the environment from the rapacity of those nasty capitalists. And my booklet, Is Capitalism Bad for the Environment?, answers that argument first by comparing the actual environmental track record of the more socialist, centrally planned economies with that of the more free market capitalist economies on one hand. And then it answers five different arguments, five different allegations against capitalism, that it's indifferent to nature, that it assumes unending growth, that it leads to resource depletion, that it imposes unjust costs on others, and that it prefers the immediate to the long term, and therefore can't give us a sustainable economy or a sustainable environment. I point out what's false about every one of those charges, as well as showing that the socialist countries have a terrible environmental track record compared with the capitalist ones.
Well, actually, let's start there, Cal, and let's talk about how do we know what socialism's environmental record is? How in the world do you track that?
Well, you have to look at a lot of data. You have to look at a lot of actual historical evidence. Let me just give you an example in terms of what happened to the Aral Sea. This is one of the greatest environmental disasters in all the world, I suppose, since Noah's flood, the flood in Noah's day, right?
You're talking about a sea. I'm sorry, you cut out a little bit. You're talking about a sea in Russia, right?
Yes, the Aral Sea in the Soviet, well, the former Soviet Union. And the fate of that Aral Sea, which once was the world's fourth largest saline lake, salt lake, is one of the greatest man-made environmental disasters in history. Because the Soviet Union decided to change the flow of some rivers in order to feed its agricultural work, the Aral's water level dropped by over 75 feet. It lost 80% of its water volume. Its salinity soared, and that devastated its fish populations. That loss of water volume reduced its capacity to moderate local temperatures, which brought hotter summers, colder winters, and stronger winds. Extreme desertification and salination around it made surrounding land useless, and windstorms from 90 to 190 miles in diameter, strengthened and enlarged by the loss of the Aral's former moderating effect, carried salt-laden dust up to 300 miles, ruining vast amounts of agricultural land. The regional biodiversity, both in the sea and on land, declined steeply, and the regional population, numbering over 60 million, was impoverished. And that's just one example. I mean, we could go into others, like China's building of the Three Gorges Dam on the Yangtze River that flooded millions of acres and displaced literally millions of people. And it's the dam is built on a geologic fault and could break because of an earthquake at any time. These things are crazy, and there's nothing that begins to compare with them in free market countries.
You know, Cal, let me talk about something you discuss in your pamphlet or your booklet that I'm very well aware of, including Russia, because I lived in Berlin before the wall fell down and used to travel into East Berlin. And I've also been to Russia. I spent 3 weeks in Moscow a number of years ago before the Soviet Union broke up. My point in telling you that is this, that one theme that I can gladly relay is that dirty. Everything was dirty.
Yep.
People didn't care about anything because the government didn't really care about people. They were just workers. Just fill in the blank. And so if they don't care enough to be clean, even their airlines were filthy. The Russian airlines, I'll never forget being so happy to get on Lufthansa after being there for 3 weeks. I thought I'd never see clean again. If they don't care about just the very everyday ordinary cleaning or cleaning their city or their streets, which had trash everywhere, what makes us think they would be spending $1 million on cleaning an environment for some theoretical, cleaner air for people to breathe or cleaner water for them to drink? They didn't care about that.
Yeah, Sandy, it's, we could go into all kinds of technical explanations. We could give a lot more historical examples. And what you just gave is excellent because it's personal, direct observation. But there are two really, really simple ways to explain this for people. The first one is to ask this question. Why do you find graffiti on public bathroom walls and not on your bathroom walls at home? And the answer to that is really pretty obvious. Nobody cares about public bathroom walls because they don't really belong to anybody in particular. So nobody's thinking in terms of, I want to preserve the value of this for potential sale in the future. Whereas your home, your bathroom walls at home, you own your home. you own your bathroom, or at least you're paying rent there. If you're a renter, by the way, you're less careful about this than an actual owner. But you own it, you want to take care of it, you want to be able to get a good resale value out of it, all those things, you have an incentive to take good care. So private ownership is much more likely to take good care of things than so-called public ownership. That's the difference between capitalism and socialism. Then the other simple thing is this. If you want to see the dirtiest part of town, where do you go? Do you go to the wealthiest neighborhoods or the poorest neighborhoods? And again, the answer's obvious, but why is that answer so obvious? It's obvious because a clean, healthful, beautiful environment is a costly good. It costs something to do that. And wealthier people can afford more costly goods than poorer people can. Now go back to what we recognized in the history of the contest between socialism and capitalism in creating wealth and getting it into the hands of more people. Capitalism makes more wealth and gets it into more people's hands. That's why capitalism results in a cleaner, healthier, more fruitful, more beautiful environment than socialism does, because a clean, healthful, beautiful environment costs, and wealthier people can afford it more.
You know, Cal, we should probably, the illustration that you offer, which I've heard before, but you reminded me of it as I was reading your booklet, that the environmental movement, the people who populate it and lead it, are actually called, in jest, the watermelons. Could you please explain that? And that will help explain what we're talking about here.
Yeah, that metaphor for them arises from the fact that the founders of the green parties around the world are, in so many instances, people who were previously members of the socialist or communist parties of their lands. And when they found that they couldn't push their message by saying that they would take better care of people, that they would make them wealthier and pull them out of poverty, they decided, we'll tell them we're going to take care of them by protecting their environment instead. So they used to be red, and then they became green. But the fact is that they're still red on the inside. So watermelons are green on the outside, red on the inside. And that's the case with an awful lot of people toward the tops of the major environmental organizations around the world. What's really sad is that so many rank-and-file grassroots supporters of these don't understand this. They don't recognize that. And, you know, of course, we have our public education system to thank for the failure to teach people history and economics.
Oh, then that explains really, in a nutshell, why the Green New Deal is so much about economics and destroying businesses and buildings and redistributing wealth and giving people who don't work money, because it really isn't about green. It's about the system of government. It's about power and control.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, the Green New Deal is all about pushing socialist policies under the banner of environmental protection. And the environmental protection won't happen because the socialist policies will impoverish people and take property out of private control into public control instead. And what we have seen from the track record of history is that poor people can't support a clean, healthful, beautiful environment, and public ownership leads to abuse of property rather than to real care and stewardship of it.
So, Cal, let's go to these, at least some of these charges. We're going to have to take a break in a second here, but the first one, charges against capitalism by the watermelons, by the Greens, by the AOCs, that capitalism, that greedy, horrible, no good system, is indifferent, you say, to nature. In other words, doesn't care about the environment or anything, or the lawn that you just mowed. By the way, that's personal. Cal just mowed his lawn. But we don't care about beautiful trees and streams and clean water. What's the truth about that?
Well, I think that this is really the weakest of the various different arguments. Of course, you know, indifference to nature is a matter of personal motivations, but it's not a matter of a particular economic system. Capitalism and socialism are both impersonal economic systems. Only persons have motives. And so, okay, look, there are sinners wherever we go. Capitalists are sinners. Socialists are sinners. So are some capitalists indifferent to nature? Yes. So are some socialists. But the fact is that because capitalism puts the ownership of as much nature as possible into private hands, and because people are, in fact, by nature, selfish, and they want their own best, they want to take good care of what belongs to them because it is their property. It's something that they can benefit from over time. So capitalism actually does more to overcome human indifference to nature than does socialism.
Okay, so that's the first point, and that's just one of them. We have a lot of things to talk about. Actually, I want to get into some of the things that the radical leftists are saying about capitalism and about the environment, because you've heard them. You hear them on, in fact, I'm going to play a clip from HBO in just a second. It'll give you an idea. So don't go away. My guest is Cal Beisner. By the way, it's cornwallalliance.org. His new booklet is called Is Capitalism Bad for the Environment? Is it? Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Possesses two idiots like yourselves to teach eight-year-olds that the planet is doomed.
The children are constantly bombarded with climate change. It is all over the news.
It's our job to deconstruct it so that they can process it.
Good for you. You deconstructed my little girl into a coma.
Now, Renata, look, we scheduled an assembly for this evening. Okay, you are not the only parent complaining, just by far the loudest.
You're pitiful.
Okay, this is gonna come as a shock to you. This school is actually here to serve all the children, not just Amabella.
You think because of this whole bankruptcy thing that the school thinks I don't matter? I will be rich again. I will rise up. I will buy a polar bear for every kid in this school. And then I will squish you like the bug that you are. And you can't be bothered to squish you.
You're a model citizen, Renata. I told you, these second-grade mothers, they are Shakespearean.
All right, so that's from, in case you don't know, because I didn't know, that's from HBO's Big Little Lie series, which I'm not promoting, by the way. I'm just illustrating to you how mainstream this discussion is. And you can tell from that clip, even though I don't know the characters, that obviously the mother there, you thought at first she was making a point, but then we know that she's supposedly rich, and that makes her an object of derision. And she's rich and does not believe in man-made global warming, and so you get the point. And that's what people are faced with every day, whether it's television, late-night comedians, HBO specials. It's just the same thing with as we had with evolution. It just became imprinted on, you know, displays in museums, and it became the lie that was made mainstream. And so this is the same. Other things that you're hearing about man-made global warming is that there's declining birth rate because of man-made global warming. And then you heard Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez tell us a few minutes ago that we only have 12 years to live because of it. It causes more tornadoes. It causes Indian tigers to eat more people. And it causes mass extinctions, just in case you had not heard those points. And by the way, there's an article on Fox by Maxim Lott that kind of refutes those things. We'll put that on our Facebook page so that you can see it. Plus, we'll put Cal's new booklet on our Facebook page as well. Is Capitalism Bad for the Environment? You can go to cornwallalliance.org, cornwallalliance.org, and order your copy. It would be a great resource. It's a booklet, so we're not talking about hundreds and hundreds of pages. It's very readable. It's a great resource. And Cal tells me that from now to the end of the year, for a donation of any amount, they'll send that book to you. So cornwallalliance.org. Cal, I think before I ask you the first question, it would be interesting to have you react to what all those things I just said and to that illustration from HBO.
Well, first, let me clarify. It's from now to the end of June, and they do have to ask for it.
But
for a donation of any size, we will send free a copy of Is Capitalism Bad for the Environment if people ask for it. And all they have to do is to go to cornwallalliance.org, scroll down to the donate button, click on it, and fill it out, and we'll be glad to do that. And 100% of their donation is tax deductible. So that's that. The clip was rather funny. There is such smugness on the part of the proponents of global warming fear-mongering. They just think that they've got it all. And the reality is that over 31,000 scientists have signed what's called the Oregon Petition, which says that there is no persuasive scientific evidence that human emissions of CO2 and other greenhouse gases are causing or are likely in the future to cause dangerous global warming, but that instead the best scientific evidence is that adding more CO2 to the atmosphere makes all the plants grow better, and that means more food for everything that eats plants or eats something that does eat plants. And that's good news for all animals. It's good news for people. It's especially good news for the poor. But we do have these folks who just think that they know it all, that anybody who disagrees with them is stupid, and they'll claim that that's because of scientific consensus. And scientific consensus, though, is really a sort of an oxymoron. It's a confusion of terms, because consensus is a political value, not a science value. Consensus is how you figure out who won an election. You count votes. But science is about looking at evidence to try to figure out what's true and what's false. And you don't count votes for that. Instead, you look at evidence, you look at the logical structure of arguments and things like that. And consensus really has nothing to do with it. In fact, one of the great philosophers of science, Robert Merton, back in the 1930s, wrote an important essay on the philosophy of science that in other walks of life, skepticism is looked at as a vice, but in science, skepticism is a virtue. And what's sad is that so many people now think that if you are a skeptic about any scientific claim, you're somehow a science denier. In reality, you're a science affirmer, because skepticism is the hallmark of science.
Isn't it interesting? I think Jake Tapper proved that in his exchange with Mike Pence at the top of the show. Where Mike said, well, not all scientists, Jake is trying to tell Vice President Pence that virtually all scientists believe in man-made global warming. And I've known him for a long time. Vice President Pence comes back and says, no, not all scientists believe that. And of course, Jake mocks him because he says that. It's really an illustration of your point.
Sandy, if you really are wanting to look at the consensus question, the actual surveys of the scientists themselves tell us that about as much as that they have a consensus about is simply that, adding CO2 to the atmosphere probably makes it warmer than it otherwise would be. I believe that. So does every climate change or global warming alarmist skeptic I know. They all agree with that. And the other part of the consensus is that global average temperature has risen by probably about a degree, maybe 1.2 degrees Celsius since 1850. Those are the only two things on which you really get widespread scientific consensus. On the question whether that warming is dangerous or is likely to become dangerous, there's no consensus there. On the question whether it would be justifiable for us to spend trillions and trillions of dollars trying to diminish that warming, there's no consensus there. So what happens is that even those who depend on the claim of consensus are manufacturing a consensus where there isn't one.
Cal, let me just, while I'm thinking about it, Jake also mocked Vice President Pence when he made the claim that the United States had cleaner air and water than, I forgot what his comparison with, any nation, any free nation, I'm not sure what nation. And Jake said, that's just not true. And so I wonder what your thoughts are about that. Is that not true?
Well, I think there are probably some nations that have cleaner air and water than the United States. Switzerland comes to mind. I think that's fairly likely. One would have to look at raw data from a lot of different places, and I haven't done a lot of that. What I can tell you is this, that the hard data in terms of the concentration of various air, water, and solid waste pollutants in the United States, the hard data show us that that has been going down, 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 down for decades, starting clear back in the 1940s, as a matter of fact, but the steepest from the 1970s onward. And our air is cleaner now than it has been at any time since the beginning of the 19th century, 200 years ago. And it is certainly cleaner than the air in the vast majority of countries all around the world, including countries in Western Europe. Anybody who has traveled to Western Europe and walked through the cities there knows the difference between the air you breathe there and the air you breathe in most American cities here. It's much dirtier there, partly because they use so many more diesel vehicles. Their streets are dirtier. There are all kinds of different comparisons that are just obvious to anybody who walks through.
Cal, it's probably, I bet you don't disagree with me on this. It's just a little, I think we have to say that the environmentalists of the late 70s or the 70s probably had a great deal to do with our cleaning up our air and our water and bringing things to attention that we weren't paying attention to, and also to industry. So we need to say thank you to them. I think that was a very good thing. So where do you draw the line, the good part and the bad part of it?
Yeah. Well, first of all, yes, I definitely agree with you on that. The environmentalists of the 50s, 60s, 70s, many of them, I think, had very salutary impact on public policy. They did contribute to our efforts in cleaning up the air and the water and so on. There is a question, frankly, in terms of history, just how much of an impact they had and how much is attributable to them versus how much was attributable simply to the fact that as people get wealthier, they like a cleaner environment and they take the steps, they can afford to take the steps to achieve that. Because all of the downward trends in our pollution emissions and in pollution concentration began before significant environmental regulation started in the United States at the federal or the state level. And it seems to have happened more rapidly before a lot of the regulation than after the regulation. So it's an interesting historical question. Economists will debate it for generations to come, and probably nobody will prevail in that debate. But yeah, I'm thankful to them. You know, we all are called by the Lord to be good stewards of this earth. That's, I think, the meaning of Genesis 1:28 that says that we are supposed to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over it. That dominion should reflect God's own dominion. God's dominion is one that we see in the earlier part of Genesis 1. He created all things out of nothing. He made order out of chaos. He made light out of darkness. He made life out of non-life. He made a great abundant variety of life. And he instructed all these varieties of life to be fruitful and multiply. So God's dominion is a creative and beautiful dominion that favors life and beauty and so on. So ours should reflect that. That's why the Cornwall Alliance says, our task in fulfilling the Genesis 1:28 mandate to have dominion over the earth, this should be a godly dominion that looks like this. Men and women created in God's image, laboring lovingly together to enhance the fruitfulness, the beauty, and the safety of the earth for the glory of God and the benefit of our neighbors.
Beautiful. And very, you know, very well said, Cal, as usual. Let's get practical in the few minutes that we have here, because in your booklet, Is Capitalism Bad for the Environment? You talk about these charges against capitalism, and one of them, I want to go to this one, that it imposes unjust costs on others. And what is the accusation more clearly, and what's the defense?
Yeah. Well, the accusation is that, of course, you know, various businesses emit pollution, and that pollution harms others around those businesses, and those harms are an unjust cost imposed on others by the businesses, and so that's a bad thing, and that's what capitalism does. Well, the fact is that businesses in socialist countries emit pollutants as well. The difference is that in a socialist country, most of the businesses are owned and supported by the government. When you have a complaint against a given business, it's rather difficult to bring a successful lawsuit. Whereas in free market capitalist countries, you recognize pollution as a form of trespass. And under common law, which prevailed in Britain and the United States for hundreds of years and is still an important part of American law, you have the concept of torts, injuries. And you can go to court and say, so-and-so is injuring me, and the judge can issue a cease and desist order regardless how much it costs the business to cease and desist. So actually, pollution that harms neighbors is not a market failure. It's a government failure to enforce the rule against harming your neighbor.
All right, I'm going to jump in, Cal.
It's not a capitalistic failure. It's a government failure.
All right, so if you want to read more about that, and there are so many fascinating background stories that Cal gives as to why a capitalism, in fact, is not bad for the environment. But the booklet is called Is Capitalism Bad for the Environment? You can get it by contacting cornwallalliance.org, requesting the book, make a donation of any amount to Cornwall Alliance, and they will send it to you. Cal Beisner, founder and president of the Cornwall Alliance. Thank you, Cal. Appreciate your time and your expertise always. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.